Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 19th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Job, Standing in Dust and Ashes, presented by Michael Pollitt. This number, POM-2005-07.
And welcome. This is our second session on a study of Job. Looking at Job in terms of the issue of faith, relationship to God, what does it tell us about God, who God is, and who we are. I picked some sections from the book of Job that will kind of act as a foil to the understandings of God, calling, vocation, faithfulness, that is in our theme text this year from Exodus chapter 3. So we have kind of two different ways of thinking about and working through how it is that we relate to God, how it is that we understand God and our life in and with God. Last time, in the first session, we looked at Job chapters 1 and 2, and again found out that what happens there is that there is this discussion, this dialogue that goes on in heaven between, of all characters, God and Satan. Satan, who is, if you will, one of God's employees, head of Homeland Security, CIA, and the FBI. Quite the role to have. And basically to go around and check and ensure and make sure that everybody in the world is in order, doing what they are supposed to be doing. And if they are not, it is Satan who will bring the accusation to God. And God, feeling pretty good one day, I guess, decides to talk to Satan about his servant Job. And that raises the question, because Satan asks God, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" So in other words, is there a kind of conditional understanding between God and humans? Or if you will, is covenant really simply a contract? And that faith is a kind of, and blessing are a kind of cost-benefit analysis. And that there are benefits both for us and, quite frankly, both, and also for God, which is kind of the shocking side of this. But I think Job asks us to think that through as well. And so we have that question, and God tells Satan, well, let's test that out. Let's see what happens and how that question will be answered. And so we read then that in these chapters here, total devastation falls upon Job. In chapter 1, he loses everything he has, and yet he seems to respond in a faithful way. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name, blessed be the Lord. Satan comes back again and says, yes, but affect his health. And so Job has sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. And yet in that one, this time Job's wife says, well, you know, Job, things are pretty bad. Why don't you curse God and die? But Job does not do that. He again offers an affirmative response, and we left it with that open question. Is that response that Job gives us toward the end of chapter 2 the same and as faithful as what Job said at the end of chapter 1? And I'm sure all of you were mulling that all night long and the answer to that, so we can proceed on. And so that brings us to today's session. It's as if Job's sufferings aren't bad enough, from chapter 3 or chapter 4 forward, and we're in the middle of this now, Job has three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. All of you who are looking for names for kids. Here's three, you know, it's certainly not as common as, you know, Michael, of which there are at least four or five in the village. I'm sure if you name one of your grandchildren Zophar, it would be the only one in the room. Oh, yeah, I know. Anyway, we have these three friends who come and supposedly comfort and console Job. And I think, again, part of the worst part, probably gallows humor in all of this, the worst part of Job's suffering is to have to put up with these friends. Because their understanding in all of this is that the reason this must be happening to Job is that somewhere, somehow, some way, sometime, he must have done something wrong. And if he would simply repent, if he would own up to that, then God would remedy the situation. And so these friends go, and Job go at it. Each friend, I guess this is kind of a proto-baseball understanding. Each friend, there's three dialogues they have, and then they're gone, kind of three strikes and you're out rule, as it were, here. And so each one of these, like Eliphaz, tries to console Job. Job responds. Then Bildad, Job responds. Then Zophar, Job responds. They do this three times. And where we're going to plunk in here, into the middle of Job, is looking closely at Job chapters 23 and 24. And as I've indicated on the board, what that does is it presumes Eliphaz's third dialogue, and I'll summarize that very quickly, and then we'll get into Job's third response to Eliphaz. So we're coming to the end of all of these consoling, comforting dialogues that the friends give to Job. This is round three here in this battle. And each time you go around, you see Job's friends, and Job as well, become more intense. So that Eliphaz started out kind of very hesitant and reluctant and gentle toward Job. And we'll see a few indicators here in chapter 22. Eliphaz has now taken the gloves off. And it becomes pretty tough. The first thing that Eliphaz does is, again, he asks the question, and we get to see again the issue that is here. So in chapter 22, would someone read verses 2 through 4 for us? Job 22, verses 2 through 4. Anyone, please.
Can a mortal be of use to God? Can even the wisest be of service to him? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous? Or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? Is it for your piety that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you?
Okay. How would you put those questions into your own words? What's Eliphaz's point?
Does it make any difference? One of the
points. Does it make any difference about what?
How good you are. I mean, maybe you're being punished for how good you are. The piety, wasn't it?
Yeah, okay. So does it make any difference whether you're pious or not?
Or that you're too pious.
Whether you're too pious?
I
Others, what do you think the question
kind of
is?
Like you're a little peon and God's up here. So what do you really matter anyway?
Is it also asking the question if would God have brought this on him if he didn't deserve it?
Yeah.
In verse 4, is it for your piety that he reproves you and enters the judgment with you? Sort of, yes. If you think back to chapter 1, that is kind of why God entered into judgment with Job. So there's this question actually is getting at something that happened.
That Eliphaz is a tricky rhetorical dude, isn't he?
Yeah.
Because all of these, he's asked, does it make any difference? Could God care? And the thing is, the answer to all those questions is, yes, God cares. It does make a difference. You are supposed to be useful. And then with a kind of double irony, for we the readers who know what that question was, way back there in chapter 1, do you fear God? Does Job fear God for nothing? We know that the whole test and everything that is going on here, it does make a difference. Not in terms of God's relationship with Job, and we think Job's relationship with God, but it makes the whole difference in terms of how we understand who God is and what faith is all about, right? So that again, those challenges, if you will, of kind of a conditional theology and a cost-benefit analysis of faith, or whether faith and God are something totally different from that, are precisely the questions that are raised here again. So the stakes are very high. It does make a tremendous difference, even though it seems at first that it's all insignificant and there's no difference at all. Right? It's kind of that subtle way, and then not so subtle way, it's there. Then it happens, and this is where Eliphaz takes the gloves off. And remember, we heard in chapter 1 that Job is upright and blameless, fears God, and turns away from evil. Here's what Eliphaz thinks that Job has done. And I'll just read a few things here and quickly paraphrase. This is verses 5 through 11. Right? Is not your wickedness great? There is no end to your iniquities, right? I mean, Job here now is chief of sinners, right? I mean, and look at all the things. You've exacted pledges from your family for no reason. Again, totally the opposite of what we know Job did in terms of maybe if his kids goofed up, even in their hearts, he gave sacrifices. Total, I mean, now he's saying, you've made them like sacrifice to you for no reason. Strip the naked of their clothing. Right? I mean, that's really, how do you strip the naked of? I mean, people are naked and you're stripping them. Now that's really evil, right? I mean, that's bad. And on it goes with that kind of exaggeration. You've given no water to the weary, withheld bread from the hungry. Verse 9, you've sent widows away empty-handed, and the arms of the orphans you have crushed. Right? That's pretty brutal, right? That's the Simon Legree character, right? Kicking widows out of homes, stealing candy from babies, and breaking their arms if you have to just to get it. Right? That's how evil Job is. And you go, wow, isn't that kind of ridiculous and all of that? But you see, there again, I think what's happening here is that wonderful insight into our own experiences. If we buy the conditional theology, if someone is suffering, if something bad happens to someone, and we think that they are being punished or there's some kind of retribution, usually the way we like to think about that is certainly they must be far more evil than they really are. Right? I mean, isn't that the way we like to think about things?
Or far more evil than me.
Well, yes. That's one of my favorite hymns, and I hear now in the new hymn book that in the Lutheran Church that they're working on now. It's going to be in there, and I'm glad. Maybe you've sung it too. Chief of sinners though I be, everyone else is worse than me. It's going to be in the new hymnal. All right. Because we love to sing that song, don't we? And to make sure that everyone else is worse than me. I mean, that's what Eliphaz is doing there, isn't it? Kind of helping Job along. And that's what we, right? I mean, that's kind of what gossip is all about. When we, you know, no matter how bad things might be, when gossip is at work, it'll be worse. Because we just love that. Right, I mean, because that's the way in which we can make all that conditional reasoning and approach to things work. We like to give it that kind of hyperbolic touch in everything that's there. And Eliphaz is a master at it. And so then, what do you have to do? What is Eliphaz's remedy or advice? This is verses 21 and 22. Let's say 23. If someone would read verses 21, 22, and 23 of chapter 22, please. This is the remedy.
Agree with God and be at peace. In this way, good will come to you. Receive instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove unrighteousness from your tents.
Okay. So there you go. Right. Agree with God. Again, in the Hebrew, the word that's translated there, agree, would literally mean be of use. Make yourself useful to God, like you're supposed to do. I mean, that's how you live a good life, a godly life, is be useful to God, right? Be useful to God, be at peace, and then in this way, good will come to you. Listen to that, verse 23, if you return, and return is the Hebrew word metaphor for repent. Repenting is returning to God. So what Eliphaz is basically saying here, you know, shape up, be useful, repent. And then all of the good things will come back. And you can see there too that whole conditional understanding is presented in the way that, you know, all those, note how often those the word, that little word if shows up. In verse 23. If you return, if you remove, if you treat, if the Almighty is your gold and all that, then you will delight yourself, verse 26, and everything will be happy. Right. If then, great conditional stuff at work, cost-benefit analysis, how we should understand that. So we've got Eliphaz's advice to Job and how to understand who God is, what faithful response is all about, so on and so forth. And again, we know right off from chapter 1, verse 1, this can't be true. This is bad advice. This isn't going to work. So, what is Job going to do about this? How will he respond? Chapters 23 and 24. And the way that that Job is going to respond in terms of this, chapter 23, Job's response is very more personal. It's talking about Job's own seeking for God. And chapter 24 broadens that in terms of thinking about all the poor, all the oppressed, all who suffer, and what that might mean. And so he kind of broadens and deepens the question that we're trying to pursue. The other thing, again, kind of a little irony and humor here, is that in chapters 23 and 24, Job is responding to Eliphaz, but it's rather indirect. That as we look at what Job is saying, he's really saying, you know, I need to talk to God. And quite frankly, you know, Eliphaz, I've heard you, and who cares? You know, you can listen in on this conversation if you want to. But really, this questioning, what I'm talking about now, is a dialogue with God. And so what we have here in chapters 23 and 24, I think, is Job wanting to talk to God. And so, as we begin to look into that, first of all, chapter 23, verse 2, and as I put it on the board here, that already gives us a conundrum how to interpret this passage. And maybe we can't answer that till we get toward the end of the class as we've thought through a few things, but the question there, and the reason we have to talk about that interpretation, and again, I'll read from the New Revised Standard. It says, "Today also my complaint is bitter," and then at least in this version here, it has a little footnote, and you can go down and look, and it also says that in the Hebrew, it says rebellious. And so now we have one of these wonderful little things that the Hebrew text, what they do is originally what you had were just all the consonants, and you have to supply the vowels. And what we have here in the Hebrew is a word which has the same consonants, but if you give it different vowels, one way you can read it is bitter, another way you could read it is rebellious. And again, noting that this part of Job is poetry, you'd say, you know, poets like to do terrible things like that to you. Is Kate here? She's one of those vengeful poets that do things like that to us, right? But right, that's one of the great things about poetry. But of course, now this gets us to think. And so at least preliminarily here, what about that? When Job says, "Today also my complaint is bitter," or "my complaint is rebellious." How do you understand Job in all of his suffering and his responses to God? Is Job bitter or is he rebellious? Or doesn't it make any difference that they're both the same? And then one more question is, how does the notion of bitter or rebellious give us some insight into faith? Can you still be faithful and be bitter and or rebellious?
Yes.
Or is being either bitter and rebellious a way of talking about unfaith, lack of faith? Where do you want to go with that? Do you want to go anywhere with that right now? Or do you want to, like I do, just move on? No. Well, any initial responses to the question that's raised there?
I kind of think it's part of our humanness, and that we're called to work out our faith through this human condition. And so, in some ways, it's the nuts and bolts of growth.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So to be, do you think Job is bitter or rebellious?
Probably both. I don't know if I could come down on one side.
Okay.
And either
yes.
One of them, I'm not sure that I really care, because both of them make me feel like there's some passion involved. So at least he has something going on. I mean, he's thinking about it to feel either one or to be reacting in either way.
Okay.
Can the bitterness and rebelliousness be a short-term condition where the faith is more of a long-term bedrock of his life?
So that kind of being bitter or rebellious is just a phase he's going through?
Yeah, an initial reaction to something.
An initial reaction.
His faith is not shakable over the long term.
It's
seems to me it's, I mean, when I think of the words bitter and rebellious, I think of teenager. And I think there's a parallel in what's faith-like. I think if you don't go through sort of the teenagerhood in your faith life, you don't really develop into more maturity in your faith.
You don't grow.
Mm-hmm. You stay with the Sunday school gods, mm-hmm. the metaphor I use.
To me, they seem like very different words, actually. I think rebellious is active and positive. Bitter, to me, seems somewhat resigned, almost. So I sort of see them as different. I don't know if it's, how important that is, but for me, a person rebelling is, you know, still active and on a kind of faith journey. Bitter is a little more problematic, I think. It's a little more disturbing mm-hmm. as an emotion. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on and see as we work our way through this chapter if things will get clearer or as we, like Job, will be in even more darkness. Verse 3, and it keeps going. Oh, that I knew where I might find him. And here the him is a reference to God. That I might come even to his dwelling. So Job's request here is, you know, what I want here. I'm searching, I'm seeking, I'm trying to find God. And note in some senses, or at least as I look at this and as he continues there, it's not with any conditions attached. Like, I want to find God so that I can gain wisdom. I want to find God so that I can share in God's glory. I want to find God and live happily ever after. It's just, I want to find God. And that's it. And again, I think poetically in that, it's very dramatically expressed in verses 8 and 9. If I go forward, he is not there. Or backward, I cannot perceive him. On the left, he hides, and I cannot behold him. I turn to the right, but I cannot see him. If you would, please, turn to Psalm 139, verses 7 to 12. And again, someone read that. Psalm 139, 7 to 12.
Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light around me become night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you.
Okay. See how those passages say the same thing?
Oh.
Okay, so I'm Hashatan, I'm sorry. No, right? They're the exact opposite. And I think for most of us, Psalm 139 is the more familiar and probably the one that's more in our own working faith lives, isn't it? That, you know, no matter where we go, to the highest heavens, the deepest pits of hell, north, south, east, west, God is always there. God is always present. Note how Job is parodying that to tell us the exact, right? No matter where I go, forward, backward, up, down, left, right, you're always absent. The always present absence of God is what Job is talking about. What do you think about that? Right, again, two very different theological understandings of God in the life of faith.
Don't you think this is bitterness talking? I still see a hope. I mean, he is looking. At least up until this point, he is looking for God in everything. He's going everywhere. And so I see that as a faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think you're very, very accurate about that, and that there is certainly hope. I mean, Job is searching. There is that hope that God will be found. But what else? I mean, what about this whole sense of the absence of God?
Well, I think it's real for a lot of people. I mean, I think we can get to that place where it just feels and seems like, you know, God's not there. He's not helping me out any.
The thing I like about Job is that he is not afraid to give voice to what he's going through. And it, we read into it, well, is he bitter about this, or does he have faith about this, or is there hope behind it? I'm not sure if Job gave any of those words a thought. He just, what he did do was give voice to what he was going through.
But isn't God, there also, oh, yeah. Isn't there also a kind of theme through Scripture that God can withdraw himself from us? Protection, Jesus, you know, his comment, why have you forsaken me? That sense of abandonment, that's real. Not just because of circumstance.
But it's also, I think you said yesterday, how parents have to let their children go. And I think it's the time of God letting us go and coming back to him and growing.
Yes, please.
I just wonder if God's letting him go, or if God's making all these religious traditions and platitudes and expectations go. Get rid of that stuff, because that's not where it's at. It's a move from religion to faith.
What does that mean, Paul? Say more. How do you understand, or how could you expand on that sense of a move from religion to faith?
Religion is, for Job, is spelled, well, Eliphaz does it, these are the steps you take for salvation or for redemption or for righteousness. These are the steps that you take. Well, perhaps we get rid of that and acknowledge grace, acknowledge that God is present in the face of bitterness and rebelliousness. I guess a different, here's a phrase, walking on the water instead of the firm earth. And the firm earth are all these religious steps to take. And strip those away, and now what do you have? And what Job has is he's still talking to God. He's got a million questions, but he isn't talking to his wife or his pastor.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of bizarre too, isn't it? That on the one hand you say God is absent, and yet you're talking to God. You know, what kind of craziness is that?
Is this sense of God forsakenness that he's having sort of one more level of his suffering? You know, we got the losses, then we got the sores, and now we have this deep sense of, you know, not knowing what's going on, of being God forsaken. And if that's true, then I would say it's bitter more than rebellious. I mean, it's even a deeper kind of suffering, which is that which I always knew, and this wonderful faith that comes out when he's first bereaved. Even that is gone.
Yeah, it's true. If God's gone, there's no point in rebelling. I mean, it's pretty down there.
But he's talking to him.
Yeah.
You
it's
know,
not
so
a apostasy,
come back around
is it?
Again. No. It's just
hope.
Despair. It's just the dark
night. Yeah, right.
Yes, please.
I just was thinking that, I mean, maybe in some sense, rather than trying to read too much into it, it could instead be perceived as sort of a snapshot of his internal state. I mean, he's talking to God. God is always present. God is always there. I mean, as you say, parroting the psalm with his dialogue, but he's not really receiving a response in the way of what he's looking at. And I mean, one of the more upsetting things you can have is when you're talking to someone and then they stop talking back. And it's not that they've left you or that they're not a presence anymore, but that when they're just not talking to you anymore, that can be very, very upsetting, especially if you're in a state where you really, really need to talk. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe married couples around the room could probably.
Oh, let's not go there. Yeah, no, I mean, that's right. I mean, if you're in a dialogue and one partner is silent, that's not a great dialogue, is it? It's kind of tough. I mean, that sense of the absence of God, but that other side, you know, Job saying, where is God? You know, where are you, God? And yet again, it's not totally alone, because in verse 10, Job says, but God knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come out like gold. So on the one hand, right, God, where are you? And yet, God, you know what's going on. So both of those things are there, and that, you know, that tension. And I think the faith there is the sense that in our experiences of suffering, we do have that feeling of abandonment, of loss, the absence of God. And that is real, true, genuine. Right? And to deny that and to kind of make it all better or something is again, just false and certainly bad theology. And yet at the same time, there is not total abandonment. Right? That sense, this is where faith comes in that, you know, one little phrase by Luther, the unknown, unfelt, untried love of God. Right? It, you know, it defies, in that sense, it defies all empiricism. You can't see it, touch it, smell it, taste it, hear it, and yet it's there. Right? God loves even though there is no understanding whatsoever, no evidence that would show this is the case. And you see, that again is that indirect rebuttal to Eliphaz, isn't it? Eliphaz is saying, well, you know, the evidence clearly shows you are being punished by God. And Job says, no, that's not that. The evidence does not show that. However, I have no evidence to support my position. Right? That's the conundrum. Right? The evidence doesn't show what you've said, Eliphaz, but I have no evidence to support my position. That's where a sense, I think at that point, that's where that sense of faith comes in. All right, let's move into chapter 24, where we broaden it a bit more, and again that sense of absence it is there. Again, poetically, verse 1 of chapter 24 is very important. It's two lines of poetry that try to circle and make indicators here so that you can see some parallels between phrases or words that help us understand some of this, I think. Why? Since times of judgment are not hidden from the Almighty, do his friends not see his day, and then again, of judgment implied. So there's a parallel between times of judgment and our wanting to see that day of judgment. The Almighty, El Shaddai, in Hebrew there, and friends, and then are not hidden and not see. You can see that. If you will, kind of what this question is asking in a more colloquial translation would basically be, why can't I see God's palm, Pilate? Why isn't the divine daytimer made evident to me? Now, why would I want to see God's daytimer or God's palm, Pilate?
To know what was going to happen.
To know what was going to happen. And that sense, not even here again, if you will, Job's request is a rather modest one. Not even wanting to ask, why is it going to happen? Or ask about God's purposes and all of that, because I think in other dialogues here, Job said, well, you know, that's way too incomprehensible, and I know that, and so I'm not even going to go there. But it would just be nice to know when. Right. So chapter 23 is basically kind of saying, it would be kind of nice to know that God is around. In chapter 24, saying, and it would be kind of nice to know when God is going to be around, or when God is going to do something, isn't it? It would be kind of nice to know that, isn't it? And precisely, it would be nice to know all of that kind of stuff in terms of what I've had there, because it seems if we don't know, we're stuck with the notion of God's indifference to suffering. Just as chapter 23 seemed to leave us with God's absence, chapter 24, at the end of verse 12, seems to leave us with the notion of indifference. And again, from verses 2 through 12, we have all kinds of examples and everything about evil in the world and terrible things that are happening. And given all of that, right, verse 12 is the summary there. From the city the dying groan, and the throat of the wounded cries for help. Yet God pays no attention to their prayer. Another happy thought for the day, isn't it? It doesn't seem, because we don't have a glimpse at the divine daytimer, it seems like God isn't paying any attention. Not even in God's schedule, that there would be some sense of justice or relief or retribution for the poor, the oppressed, and that the wicked finally would get their just deserts. Or well, it seems like there is no justice because justice isn't in God's planning book. Not on the schedule. Dorothy, you want
to? Well, just tying us back to the theme verse where the burning bush speaks and says, I have heard the cries of the people who are suffering in slavery. It's the opposite of this. Again, it's another opposition. God doesn't pay attention here, but in that other passage, God is really hearing the groans that are coming from the city.
You've just ruined my fun.
I'm sorry.
That's precisely where we're going to go, right? That's why it's Exodus Shmexodus.
Okay.
Right? Turn as Dorothy. Turn to Exodus chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. Just to back up a little bit what Dorothy has said there. I know you don't have to be sorry.
I've been living with that text all year.
If someone would read verses 7 and 8 of Exodus chapter 3.
Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cries on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey.
Right. So there you have it, right? A God who hears, who sees, who knows, who delivers, who will come down and bring them up out of not only delivering them from Egypt and its slavery, but also bringing them to a land of milk and honey, right? I mean, so not only getting you out of the bad stuff, but also giving you good stuff, blessings, and all that goes with it, right? The full sense of God's deliverance. And, right, Job seems to indicate it here, at least for a moment, that there's none of that. In this sense here, from Job's perspective and from Job's experience, how does God redeem? How does God deliver? Let me answer that a little bit here. In terms of the sense here, turn to verse 22, where it says, "Yet God prolongs the life of the mighty." And again, the sense of prolong here, the literal translation would be, God drags on. So prolong is a good, right? But more gradual. Just drags out, stretches out. What? The life of the mighty, the powerful. They rise up when they despair of life. So in other words, again, all the wicked in that seem to drag on. God gives them security and they are supported. His eyes are upon their ways. But then here, if you will, this is the only little glimpse of redemption we get. They are exalted a little while. So the contrast is dragging on, and yet little while. And then are gone. They wither and fade like the mallow. They are cut off like the heads of grain. If it is not so, who will prove me a liar and show there's nothing in what I say? Right? The sense here that Job gives us of a redeeming and delivering God is simply a sense of faith that God will do this in God's own time. That's it. We don't even know whether God will hear and know our cries and come down to deliver us. That, you know, the evidence, again, doesn't seem to always bear that out. That the experience here of redemption is, I think, just simply different. I'll keep it vague here for a moment. Different from the way in which it's understood in Exodus. And again, for us, Exodus seems to be much more the paradigm in terms of the way we think about that sense of deliverance and redemption. And yet, the question to think about here, as you read the Gospels, does the experience of Jesus follow that experience of Exodus or the experience of Job?
Fiction, it's the experience of Job. You know, God, my God, why have you forsaken me? But the ultimate deliverance comes in the resurrection. So you see both.
But is that notion of deliverance that we have in the resurrection really an exodus kind of experience, or is that still a sense of, yes, there is deliverance, but certainly on Friday, no one knew.
But the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 and the healing of the sick and all the other things he did, those were all deliverance. So his life was a deliverance to the other people, but not to him.
Yes.
You said we couldn't ask the questions, but I'm going to ask them anyway, Michael. Before the Hebrew people can reach the promised land, they have to wander in the wilderness. Before Jesus begins his mission, he has to wander in the wilderness and end in that wilderness with the temptations of the, you know, up on the mountain. Before this resurrection, there's death. Does it seem, and the question then is, you have to go through a process of somehow, and that's why I think about Job, stripping away what you always believed or what might become a god to you until you get rid of that stuff in this wilderness kind of experience. Is that a theme that runs through all that?
Good question.
Well, I came here for some answers. Gall darn it.
I think as a response to that, Paul, not really a direct answer, but to put it in terms of whether that's the Exodus, the wilderness, and the coming into the promised land, or the cross and resurrection, I think the danger there again is that we always want to sneak that back into a conditional kind of theology.
Right.
So that things like, so if you are faithful on the cross and bear up under those sufferings, even though you feel abandoned, God will come and deliver you and you will be raised.
Right.
Even if you're in the wilderness and that, if you hang in there 40 years to finally kind of, sort of, maybe get it right, then you can enter the promised land. And we want to make that all conditional, right? I mean, we understand cross and resurrection, you know, again, way too crassly, you know, kind of no pain, no gain. And the problem, I think the difficulty is that we've all read the Gospels, and so that we know kind of how the story ends in terms of resurrection. And so again, we put it back into this conditional theology that says, see, sufferings, if you are faithful, will bring blessing, will bring new life. And where we're at here with Job is to say, yes, there is new life. Yes, there is resurrection. But you see, since we don't have God's day timer, since we don't see that scheduling, it's a far more questionable world and situation for us.
Right.
That, you know, it's not that the end, I mean, we like to, the ending isn't always self-assured in terms of that life of faith. Emily.
I think Dorothy brought up you brought up the Exodus text, and yes, God hears the cries of the oppressed, but those oppressed were crying to God for hundreds of years by that time. And so it wasn't as though they got trapped into slavery and started crying about their oppression and instantly God, it was several generations before Moses was called to do this. So the timeline thing leaves it pretty nebulous, pretty open.
Yeah.
There isn't a direct cause and effect.
That's right. Those who are looking for immediate gratification are going to be significantly disappointed.
Mm. Paul? But even Job, he sure doesn't, even at the end, I don't think he's got a very good deal. He's still got 7 kids that are dead.
Mm-hmm.
You still got 10.
Ten.
Right? Ten. Sorry.
7 do count.
A lot.
That was really. really a bad line, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
And he's still got, you know, all the stuff's gone, and they're not going to come, those kids aren't coming back.
Mm-hmm. And how many families have gone through that in their generations and generations? Influenza and AIDS and things that are happening now, that you lose family and get new family. That's part of life.
Mm-hmm. Was it they say the human condition? I mean, that what life is about is learning to grieve.
Yeah.
So there again, that takes us right back to chapter 23, verse 1. Is Job bitter or rebellious?
It's both.
Both. Is that bitterness faithful? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, you were going to say.
I was just going to say, I still think of it as that, I guess there's overtones of both in some sense, but still thinking of the idea of a dialogue where one person has stopped talking, essentially. I mean, basically have this little monologue that Job has, which starts with him talking about the times and hidden and then talking about God and using the name El Shaddai, which usually is looked upon as being God Almighty, but there's the other way of looking at it, where you realize it's a vulgar Hebrew term relating to my breasts, essentially. Right. He's asking for comfort. He's asking for the dialogue to be resumed and for God to him to be able to perceive that God is near again and that God's justice and ways are in the world. And so again, you know, the dialogue stopped, and so in some sense there's both the bitterness and maybe a sense of rebelliousness, but the faith is still there. He's still very aware that God is there. He wants the comfort back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think where the sense of faith comes through, I guess, Paul wants an answer, so I will give you an answer. I lean toward the rebellious side on this. And the reason for that is in terms of the dialogue and all of that. I can link the rebellious up to the faith side more in terms of even if it seems like God has stopped talking, absent, that I don't know the timetable and I haven't got a clue whether God is ever going to talk to me or not or say something, whether that comfort or what will come, you know, I'm just rebellious enough. I'm just, I guess, was it, oh no, I guess that was in the first sentence. Some folks said, you know, what about the patience of Job? And I kind of switched that to say, well, yeah, Job is patient. If you understand patience as a kind of cantankerous stubbornness, that I think here what we get, that this rebelliousness or the faithfulness, is Job is just so blasted stubborn that says, all right, God, you're not going to talk to me. You're not going to tell me what's going on. Well, you know, I just don't care because I'm going to keep talking. And, you know, sooner or later, whether you're going to talk to me or not, I'm going to keep talking and, you know, I'm going to keep talking. You got anything to say about that? And I think that's where it's, you know, that's at this point of the time where Job is at, no matter what, I won't break off the dialogue. And that's not something about, you know, what I can do and how strong, but just simply the side of faith that says the reason I won't stop talking is simply God is there. How? It's unknown, unfelt, untried, but I still, God is there. I'll keep talking. Except it's 10, so I'll stop talking. Thank you very much. I want to stay around for comments or what that's going to be.